Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Mr. Benoit, hello there, sir.
Mr. Tal, how are you, my fine feathered friend?
I am well. Why do you keep calling me fine feathered? I have no feathers.
It's, you know, at least I don't know if feathers that you have that we're going to talk about on air. So it's no big deal. How are you doing though? How was your weekend?
My weekend was awesome. It was really, first of all, the weather was absolutely gorgeous in Tampa Bay, which, you know, normally is. And then Aaron and I went to see Book of Mormon, which, have you seen that?
I have. It's the funniest live production thing I've ever seen.
I would agree. Eric, have you seen it?
I have not.
You got it.
Well, you got it. Do you have any idea what it's about?
Oh yeah. It's on my list to go see. My daughter went to New York a couple months ago and I bought her tickets, her and her boyfriend, to it because I knew it would be one of those epic things, and we couldn't get Hamilton. So,
Well, that's another epic one, but totally different. So Aaron had she had heard of Book of Mormon. She had no idea what it was about. I knew she would find it absolutely hilarious. And all I told her was, look, no matter what you're expecting, it's going to blow your mind. Like you've never seen anything like it. It's so off the charts. You know, and all I told her about is, look, the people that wrote it are the people who wrote South Park. That's all you need to know, right?
How's the theater scene in Tampa Bay?
So, you know what? This was my first time. It's great. Strat Center is gorgeous. And this time I wanted to treat Aaron. We sat like where the Queen of England would sit, like at the balcony level. Actually, it sucked. Honestly, I would never sit there again. I'd much rather sit where the audience was. The one cool thing about it was we got to see the audience. We had a really good view of people's reaction to the show. And having seen the show, I was really there to watch her reaction and seeing other people's reaction, particularly people that had not seen it before and had no idea what they were getting themselves into, right? Which is a surprising amount of people go to see that show and have no idea what it's about. Anyway, it was fabulous. I had a great time. Eric, you need to go see it. Make a point of that. PJ, yeah. Let's tell our audience about Eric.
Oh, absolutely. Eric Lidke, the man, the myth, the legend on the show today. In the world of business, as we know, Tal, it takes a certain kind of metal. That's M-E-T-T-L-E, not metal.
Thanks for spelling that.
No problem. You know, I listen to metal. So anyway, it takes a certain kind of metal to make monumental shifts. And today's guest on the Braving Business podcast is the embodiment of such courage. We welcome Eric, whose name is synonymous with innovation and sustainability in the high stakes arena of global fashion and sports apparel. As the former brand president and executive board member of Adidas, Eric steered the titan of industry towards new horizons, fostering collaborations that redefined the brand from Reebok to Yeezy. Under his visionary leadership, Adidas's e-commerce platform soared to multi-billion dollar heights while spearheading material innovation and bold sustainability initiatives. Yet, after 26 remarkable years, when many would coast on the crest of success, Eric took a brave and unconventional detour. He left the familiar fortress of an established global brand to embark on a quest against public waste, a testament
plastic waste, my friend.
Plastic.
Well, you're reading.
And it's public. Yeah. You think I memorized this? Plastic waste, a testament to his unwavering commitment to the environment. As co-founder and CEO of the Unless Collective, Eric is at the vanguard of regenerative fashion, leading a crusade to overhaul the industry's approach to sustainability. This is where Eric's passion lies, in creating cool, conscientious fashion that not only appeals to the masses, but also respects Mother Earth. And today is Earth Day, so all very apropos. Join us as we delve into Eric's incredible career, his audacious departure from Adidas, a huge global company where he was well-known, well-respected, and well-compensated, and he chose to walk away in pursuit of a passion for sustainability, the very definition of braving business, if you ask me. Eric, thank you for joining us on the Braving Business podcast.
Wow, that was one hell of an introduction, PJ. Could you write for a living? Can I hire you to do some copywriting for the Unless Collective?
Well, you're gonna have to hire both of us. This is a team. This is a teamwork. Okay.
As long as I know that you guys are in the market and hireable. So anyway, perfect. Thank you very much for that. Great to be here. It's a fun opportunity.
Thank you. Eric, thanks for being here with us. We were excited to hear from your team and are happy to have you here on the show. I think we should start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you got. I mean, it's not an everyday thing that someone gets to end up leading one of the world's best known, most iconic brands. I'm sitting here wearing an Adidas shirt in your honor. But I have plenty of them because a lot of sports jerseys are made by Adidas. Tell us the journey. How did you get to where you got to?
Well, I came out of University of Wisconsin-Madison. Go Badgers, PJ. Just want to put that one right in there. Marquette.
Yeah. Side note, Marquette Warriors, unite, please. But anyway, please continue, sir.
I'll put that aside. So I came out in 1990 and market was tough. It was a recession, if you remember, if any of you guys were still aware and alive in 1990. But I found a job in advertising. It was going well. It was in Detroit. I was working on Cadillac accounts, Chiquita Banana accounts, Florist Transworld Delivery, and I kind of wasn't enjoying myself at all. If I'm not doing sports, haven't done sports or talking about sports, I'm not really a pleasant person to be around. So I hit the old contact list and found a friend of a friend who was working for Adidas in Germany. And then I went on a...
Is that how you say it? Adidas?
In Germany, yeah. So because it's named a guy named Adi Dassler. So it just took the first three letters and the first name and the last name and came up with Adidas. So anyhow... it took me a year, and this is before cell phone. This is before really email, of writing letters and calling to get into an entry position at Adidas in Portland, Oregon. Thanks to a warm introduction, but again, then it took just a resilient daily monthly drumbeat of really not harassing, but stalking for sure of the employers in Portland. And finally, I landed in my dream job in January '94, which was basically next to the mailroom of Adidas America. In Portland, Oregon.
Wow. And what were you doing? What did you do first getting in your foot in the door?
The job was called sweeper. And if you're familiar with soccer, as my friend Tao is, sweeper is the last line of defense. It's like, you know, it's not a term that's frequently used anymore. But back in the day, it was the cleanup people, the people that did everything. Didn't really have a specific job, but made sure that everything stayed in front of them. So you name it, I was doing it. And my favorite story to tell is, every Sunday night, because we used to have the teleprinters that would come in with the sales reports, right? They would run all night because, again, before emails and everything like that. And so one of the sweepers, and there was five of us because there's five business units, would have to come and take all night duty on Sunday to make sure the printer didn't jam from those old school ones. So we'd come in. Luckily, there was a half court indoor basketball place where you could shoot hoops, but you had to be on duty all night Sunday night as a youngin', making sure the printer didn't jam. So the general managers, when they came in on Monday morning, everybody had the last week's sales report. So good stuff. Learned everything from the ground up. But yeah, that was probably my favorite job. But everything else was like doing what needed to get done to, you know, make the product, sell the product, create the product, you name it, and just get to market.
So how did you end up standing out enough to rise? I mean, it's a big organization, lots and lots of people. And obviously at some point someone saw something in you. How did that happen?
I think it comes down to good old, you know, we joke, but Midwestern work ethic. I mean, it's about hustle. It's about grit. It's about resilience. It's about purpose. I mean, ultimately I was, when you hit that sweet spot of being in something that resonates so clearly with you. And again, as I said, I was naturally oriented towards sports and loved reading about it and talking about it and doing it. And I was always happier, you know, call it a obsessive compulsive disorder, having when I'm done sports. So you have that certain dopamine satisfaction. Now imagine working for a sports company where you get to do that all day long for a living. You're expected to go on a lunchtime workout or basketball game or what have you. And you're expected to come back and talk about what's happening in March Madness or what's happening in the Frozen Four or whatever it's called in the hockey college stuff. But it's like everything was topical that you cared about was there. So you just couldn't drag me out of the office at a certain point only because it wasn't a job. It was like, you know, your job was part of your life. And I know that's kind of frowned upon today with the work ethic thing and work-life balance and everything. But I think your job in life is to find something that doesn't feel like a job. It feels like something you want to go to and you want to lean into and you want to get excitement. And so it was more of a mission in my life to be great at what I was doing because I love doing it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that on this podcast, and obviously with our audience, that's made up predominantly of entrepreneurs or people that aspire to be entrepreneurs, that there's probably less of a, you know, a bad rap to being very passionate about your work. And I think what you touched on there that I want to tease out some more for the audience is the importance of being at a place where the mission really resonates with you. What was it about Adidas's mission? You loved sports and that's great, but what was it about the way Adidas did business that kept you excited?
Well, it was an interesting time, right? Because it was the early 90s. Nike was far and away kicking ass and taking names. Reebok was at that point starting to really fade, but it was still relevant in some areas. And Adidas was this, as everyone knew, it was a sleeping dinosaur. So it was like, it was this historical legacy brand that had, you know, basically Adi Dassler, you know, again, the namesake, the founder, he basically started the industry, the modern day sports industry. You know, you can go back in the history of the World Cup and the Olympic Games and all the things that the Dassers did in that to make that into sports. And, you know, read Phil Knight's Shoe Dog book or read the, you know, some of the older ones and look at the movie. It's like the movie doesn't do a great job displaying, you know, portraying the Germans, but I think the book does very clear you know, a nod or acknowledgement that Adidas was the dominant force when Phil came up and disrupted everything with Nike. When I went into Adidas, they were down. I mean, it was like, it was coming out of bankruptcy. It had been repurchased by Robert Louis Dreyfus, Rob Strasser and Peter Moore, who are two legends, are really the two guys I came to work for at Adidas. They were actually two of the original people that were with Phil at Nike. And when they came over and took over Adidas America, that's how I kind of got into following, and I'd read about them. I'd followed them. I'd studied them. I mean, Rob Strasser and Peter Moore, they're legends, right? So when I came in and had the chance to work with those two individuals, it was like a kid in a candy store. And then to say, hey, we're the underdog, that always resonates with me. We're the guys that are, we're the ones that people are doubting. We're the ones that, you know, are being counted out. We're the ones that are being called, you know, stupid or what have you, that doesn't have good product. And then to kind of rise from that and have that kind of build year on year on year, it was great. It was a comeback story for all the ages. I mean, when you're watching March Madness and you don't have a team in the game, you always, I bet, cheer for the underdog. That's just the American way. So I was working for the underdog, doing what I could and having a lot of fun doing it.
So as that was happening and Adidas, you know, the turnaround at Adidas was quite a thing, because I actually remember being, I graduated high school in 1991, and I actually came from Israel, where Adidas was still very popular in the mid-1980s, and came to the U.S., and Adidas was not terribly popular at that time. In fact, wearing Adidas was not cool. What was it like to be at a brand that was extremely well-known, but also viewed, as you said, somewhat more as a dinosaur? What was it like, you know, at that point, you were still young, not that you're not young now, but you were at the point in your career where you were really, emerging as a leader. Were you, as these very consequential decisions were made about the direction the business was going to take, did you have an opportunity to speak up about where you thought the company should go? And if you did, how did you make sure that what you said was both heard and didn't put you in a place where someone tossed you out the door?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that probably happened a little bit later. Like when I went in 94, I was green as green can be. So let's fast forward to, early 2000s, and we're still, we're coming back, but things have plateaued a bit. I'm now the head of Adidas America Footwear. And I made a very clear decision that, again, applying this kind of work ethic that I believe. So first of all, a little background. Headquarters was Germany, Herzogenaurach, Germany, where Adidas was founded, where this family grew up and everything else. And that's German-run companies typically still stay in those places. So if you wanted to affect change, you had to go to the mothership to really reorient it. I always compare it like, the Mississippi River is a business, right? So that's the funnel of things running down. And you have to get to the headwaters if you want to influence where things, how things get created and where they go. So your question is, if I wanted to influence the headwaters of Adidas, I had to go to Germany. And then I made a very clear decision that I was going to go there as often as I needed to. And I was going to stay longer than was expected for the meetings, because I believe the magic happens at the water cooler. It doesn't happen when you're, running into a meeting, doing the meeting, then catching the first flight out. No, the relationships and the soft skills of influencing others is done with, at the water cooler, at times where you can really let your hair down and have a beer maybe, and just talk about family, talk about friends, talk about life, talk about interests. And then, they come to trust you as a person. And when they trust you as a person, they're going to trust you in the office place. So I believe 1 year during that time, I went to Germany 14 times. Now, that may seem like it's not so much in today's travel times, but 14 times 1 year, that's averaging more than once a month from Portland, Oregon. Back then, there was no direct flights from Portland, Oregon. So you had to go through Delta, through Cincinnati, which is always painful when you got to stop on the East Coast on your way over to Europe. But it was that important to me to build these relationships. And it worked out so much that ultimately they ended up inviting me over to do more, at the headquarters. But it all started with that kind of commitment to, they're not the bad guys, because a lot of times German headquartered companies with American, sales offices or distribution centers or what have you, they don't get along, because the Americans always feel like they know better and the Germans feel like they know better. And it's just one clash after another. So you had to go over and say, no, let's bridge this thing together and figure out how to break the market paradigm with Nike leading it. And I'm happy to say that we were able to do that from time to time. And it starts with people getting to believe in you and trust in you and know you.
And then, well, there's a dance though, right? When you get people to trust you and you're gaining their confidence, but then trying to get them to, as Tal loves to say, speak truth to power, right? And where you're like trying to convince them to do something that's a little different, a little outside the box, so to speak. Yep. What is that like? How is that? First of all, you have to have some temetry, right? You got to have some courage in order to do that. Tell us about that. Like where you were like, okay, I feel like they know me well enough for me to do something that's a little out of the norm and for the betterment of the company.
Yep. No, I think it's a big company, right? So there's a truth to power piece, which I love. And that's one that I really lean into, especially now in my startup days when I'm trying to really, paradigm shift and systemically change industries. At Adidas, when I was in the matrix, it's more of a nuanced dance to your point. I mean, I think PJ, we really need to think about how it kind of plays together with the culture of, dealing with German executives. And I think, and if you know something about the cultures of doing business internationally, every country is a little bit different. China's different than Japan. Japan's different than Germany. Germany's different than America. And knowing that dance and knowing that, again, the passive aggressiveness, the directness, the cultural cues that go on with the nonverbal things, those are all really important things you have to learn on the fly. And so I would say like the my one observation that I always share between Americans and Germans is Americans are really passive aggressive, and Germans are not. Germans are super direct, and they've got an expression: "We're going to put the fish on the table, and if it smells, it smells, and we're going to look at it, and we're going to say, yeah, that's a fish." So they would accept direct feedback because that's their culture, and you had to do it respectfully. You had to, you know, do it in a way that did not, you know, cost somebody their face. But if I got in the room with the right people, I would absolutely give them the data in a respectful, direct way, and they would typically receive it if they hadn't already counted me off as one of those bad Americans. And I think that was, you know, they could put a pile of bad Americans over here, and if they came in and said, "Hey, you know what, this shoe is not looking great on the toe down," they're like, "Yeah, it is what it is. We're going to sell lots of it over here." But if I came in and said, "Hey, you guys, you know who I am, and we got along, and we had those beers at Oktoberfest last year, and you know, the toe down, while it's good for Europe, can we make some tweaks for it for America and maybe use the same tooling and come up from a different angle?" And they would be more than likely to say, "Yeah, we get that. We want to do that." And they would see that you understood their point of view of what they were trying to do for different markets while you're trying to add into it to be successful in your market. And it just was always constantly putting yourself in their shoes and not backing down from what you need, but finding a better way between the two parties.
Yeah, I think that that finding that camaraderie and being able to influence through those connections is kind of how you get along in life, right? Like it's all about team building and you know.
Isn't it what our parents talk to us about, you know, learn how to play in a sandbox? I mean, yeah. I honestly think you go back to that more and more in life.
Yeah. And I mean, our listeners, you know, I'm going to allude to something really fast. Our listeners may not understand that where I went to college and where you went to college are kind of rivals, right? So I'm saying this with that in mind. You know, you reached the top of Adidas, and you are you're clearly the most successful person that's ever come out of Wisconsin. So that being said, I'm just kidding. Could you describe? So you're at the top, you're floating, right? Like you got it made, but you are passionate about now sustainability. There is a certain, and you know, I mentioned temetry before. There's a crap load of temetry that's needed for you to be like, "Yep, this is the comfy life that everyone envies." But you know what? I'm going to go try something else. What was that like to take that journey?
That was a journey, and I appreciate the question because I did. I mean, I like I said, I still was that kid. You know, when I in 2019 when I walked away, I was still the kid that said, "This is the best job in the world for me." And I'm getting paid more money than I could have ever imagined, you know, if I would have like drawn a line to the 18-year-old Eric. And so, you know, I was going to every World Cup game. I was going to every Super Bowl. I was going to any sporting event I wanted to. And I had, you know, I had the penthouse suite view of everything. And it was fantastic. But so the consumer led me there, to put it in a snapshot. So what I kind of started to understand when we did the turnaround at Adidas was we did a whole strategy. We focused on through sport with the power to change lives. And that was kind of like our why, right? Simon Sinek, you know your why. And we had that why. And we did it for a sport. Okay, in sport, our consumer has three sides then: sport, life, and world. And on the sports side, of course, we're the world's best sports brand. We're going to help them kick stronger, run faster, jump higher, right? Check. But we also recognize that the culture of sport, it doesn't stop when you leave the pitch. It doesn't stop when you leave the court. It doesn't stop when you leave the playing field. It goes into the streets, the music venues, the retail stores, the arenas, and everything else. So we embrace that with doing different things differently around with Kanye West or with Beyonce or with Bad Bunny or with you name it, Pharrell Williams. It's like we embrace that culture of sport that came with it. But then our consumers were clearly telling us that they were getting stressed out. At this time, they, you know, 2014, 2015, the smartphones were everywhere. We all of our consumers were doom scrolling each and every day. Black Lives Matter, Me Too, LGBTQ plus, you know, rights. Yep. All these things were on the front page. Yep. Climate change was hitting them. And it's like, okay, when we sat around in our executive table and our strategies and with our creation people saying, okay, we know how to handle the sport thing. We figured out how to handle the life thing. What is this world? How are we going to lean into that? How do we help Black Lives Matter, or how do we help climate change? And into my door walked Parley for the Oceans, which started to educate me on the they're an ocean advocacy group. And they started to educate me on the plight of the oceans due to plastic pollution, among other things. And then you start to dig into that. Oh, 70% of apparel and fashion and sportswear is made from plastic, you know, plastic feedstock that becomes plastic pollution. So then you start to realize that, oh crap, we need to start turning down our plastic impact. And you start going down that road. And once you see and hear those things, PJ, you can't unsee and hear those things. You can only whisper yourself to sleep so many more times that, you know, at night. And by the end of 2019, I then was like, okay, I got to check out.
So I appreciate that. I think it's compelling, and I'm sure it's true. And I'm going to push you to tell me the human story behind that, because you told us the business story.
Yeah.
I want to hear about Eric.
I got kids.
Where were you in your life at that point? At some point you had to have been driving home from the office and saying to yourself, okay, I'm doing something I love. I want to assume you're working with people you cared about, and you had reach and influence, and yet something is gnawing at you that you should do something different. Tell me about that. Tell me about the conversation you were having with yourself.
Okay. So I had a 9-year-old daughter, and I was getting divorced from her mother. And so I was going through that, you know, stage, and we were Americans in Germany and going through that, you know, it was a difficult time. Let's say that. And I was watching my daughter suffer and trying to be the best divorced dad I could be. But yeah, those times are challenging. Adidas was down and out. Business was very tough when I came to the board. It all happened about the same, you know, right around the same time. And I was trying to change that telemetry as well and get that back on while juggling, you know, a single life, a new life, starting to date again and those such things. And I think I just started to really look and realize that, you know, the consumer was telling us one thing in these focus groups. My daughter was telling me another thing through, you know, unspoken communication about what pain and anxiety looks like, I think, at times. And I was feeling it all, you know, trying to hold my professional life together while going through a very personal, tough time. And these guys from Parley walked in my door and started to tell me about the plight of the oceans. And I'm a sports guy, but I'm a sports guy with a very keen affection for the water. I swam all the way through school. I did not swim at University of Wisconsin, but I stopped. Yeah, I tried. I talked to the coach a couple of times, and it just was going to be very difficult. So I didn't, but I scuba dive, I surf, I snorkel, I kayak. You know, anything I can get in the water is heaven for me. So to me, I think, to sum it up, Tal, I think I tried my best to empathize for those that I was feeling around. And hearing that and putting my foot forward into trying to create the change I wanted to see while I was at Adi, and then even accelerate more since I left.
I find that, first of all, I find it reassuring, your tale there, because it's a very human side that I think a lot of us share, right? I know Tal's gone through it. I've gone through it, where you have a divorce, unfortunately, for whatever reason, and you're still trying to keep things together as a family person. It doesn't matter if you're a guy or female. You're always looking out for your kids, and you're looking out for their futures. And for you to kind of embody that, right? Because I love that when Tal first started his question, you know, he was like, "What predicated all this?" And you were like, "I have kids, right?" And it's very succinct, but at the same time, it really tells a story of, I'm a parent, I love my kids, and when they are my age, I want them to be in a world that's hopefully not on fire and doing better, right? And so I think that's just extremely commendable. I love that.
I appreciate it. And that's very, very nicely summarized.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, that's my job.
PJ does that very well. He's a summarizer.
I'm a summarizer. That's all it says on my resume, summarizer.
Excellent.
Eric, I appreciate that. I really feel that that part of the story is the part of the story that our audience, given what our audience is interested in, appreciates as much and maybe quite probably more so than the business rationale. Not that the business rationale didn't need to be there, because ultimately, if you're going to pursue something, particularly if you're leaving a place where you're well-known, well-established, well-respected, and well-compensated, you better do it for something that you're genuinely passionate about. But very rarely are these decisions made strictly on the basis of the business. There's always the human side. And on this podcast, we've had numerous hugely successful people from the sports world, from the political arena, from the business world, from the media world. And it never fails to comfort me. As PJ said, I echo what he said about how that was reassuring. Never fails to comfort me the humanity of everyone, regardless of where they've regardless of what they achieved in life. We're all ultimately human beings, and that comes with struggles, inner turmoil, uncertainty, pain, a desire to take care of our children, and a desire to hopefully leave a better future for generations to come. So it sounds like all of those things were in play for you. Yeah. Tell me, as you were, you know, considering leaving, I'm going to call it Adidas because that's just how I know how to say it. And I'll leave it to you guys to be the snobs that say Adidas. As you were making that decision, I am sure that it occurred to you that arguably if your goal is to really influence and leave an impact when it comes to sustainability, that arguably doing it from within a big brand like Adidas, you could have arguably had a bigger impact. Tell me why you concluded that this wasn't the place to do it. And by the way, if the answer is from a personal reasons, you needed to go do something different, that's fine. I'm not looking for just the, you know, if you will, the press release. I'm looking for the story behind the story.
And I'm happy to give it to you. I get asked that quite a bit. Like, why didn't you just stay? And I was like, because I came upon this concept of fighting plastic waste in 2015. We introduced the first ocean plastic shoe to the United Nations General Assembly in June of 2015. So we started then to really get to work and pick a fight with plastic, if you will, internally. I had done everything, you know, at Adi that I could. You know, let's just call it that instead of getting down in the battles. But, you know, we eliminated plastic bags from retail. We eliminate plastic bottles from our headquarters and from all of our offices. We took out plastic beads from our beauty gels. We committed to being off of virgin polyester feedstock for apparel and footwear by 2024, which they've honored since we left, to just use recycled polyester. So we did all of these things. We galvanized, we moved a lot, and it's worth a, you know, probably billions of dollars of business to Adi today using ocean plastic. But there's only so much you can do within a big, big company like that. I galvanized as much as I could around this fight with plastic, but really everyone in the industry knows if you want to leave less harmful waste behind, microplastics, nanoplastics, and those things, you need to make things out of a different material, different feedstock, if you will. And while I knew that, there were so many competing initiatives. You couldn't really put a lot of money into that because you had to feed a lot of hungry mouths. We talked about all the sports marketing mouths from football and basketball and soccer and running. We talk about the different initiatives from doing new innovations that would include 3D printing, ocean plastics and stuff. But again, not getting off of plastics, just recalculating it in different forms. Ultimately, what I wanted to do, in my humble opinion, was to systemically change fashion from a plastic-based industry to a plant-based industry. And I wasn't going to be able to do that with all the fiduciary responsibilities at Adidas every 30, 60, 90 days that I needed to fulfill there. So I decided sometimes you have to be an outside disruptor to create internal change in the industry.
Wow. I love that. Just so you know, I'm also a fashion icon. I don't know if you know this or not, but I used to own a custom-made blue jean company. And part of that process, water reclamation is a big deal, right? Like, especially in the manufacture of jeans. So that was something that I always like tried to keep cognizant of. But not regenerative fashion, right? I just didn't have far enough vision, apparently. So this concept became, or how did this concept of regenerative fashion become a cornerstone for the Unless Collective, and what sets it apart in the industry? And also tell us more about just the name, the Unless Collective. I love this.
Okay, so let's start with the name first. So Unless Collective came, of course, from my children. So during COVID lockdown, I was on the Oregon coast reading to my children the Lorax book. At the end of the Lorax, there's a line that says, unless someone like you comes along, cares a lot, cares a whole awful lot, nothing will get better. It simply will not. And it goes on from there, but you get the idea that that is where Unless came from. I said, that's it. It was a light bulb that went off in my head. Called one of my friends who's a lawyer and said, said, can we get trademarked? He said, let me get on it. Trademarked it right away, and here we are. So that was, I think, a fantastic insight name, because naming is tough, right? Naming companies is tough, but this one has a great origin story. So what are we here to do? So ultimately, you have to start at the end, right? We always start at the end, which is really interesting if you think about from consumer goods. Hardly anybody starts at the end, but our end solution is we want to have zero harmful waste. And what I mean is, like, plastic is fantastic as an innovation. It's moldable, it's flexible, it's heat resistant, it can do all sorts of things. But ultimately, it's a forever material with forever chemicals attached to it. So it doesn't go away, it just gets smaller. And now we're finding all sorts of evidence that it's micro and nanoplastics are entering into our bodies through the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. And some of us, based upon your diet, where you live, are ingesting more than a credit card a week of plastic in your systems, where it goes into your arteries and causes more severe clotting, goes into your brains, has early onset dementia. It causes endocrine disruption, early onset puberty, you name it, precursor to cancer. All this research is coming out now almost on a daily drumbeat. So we started with, if that's the problem, let's be very, very specific on what we're trying to solve. We're not trying to be a more sustainable company. We're trying to solve for the problem of harmful waste to end of life. So once we have that as the end goal, then you simply back up and you say, okay, then how do we have to create things? And that means we have to create things that will harmlessly go away and be eaten by all the good things we have out here, the enzymes, the bugs, the bacteria that are occurring in nature, which led us to plants and minerals. You make stuff out of good stuff. And like we say, we make stuff from the environment to go out into the environment to return to the environment.
So it's fascinating. And obviously what we are hearing you talk about is the brand that you landed on, and you landed on it, sounds like, for all the right reasons. Talk to me about the behind the scenes of building a brand. I mean, you came into a well-known company, you made it bigger and stronger and better, but here you were actually starting your own. What was that like? What lessons can you share with our audience about embarking on a journey to build a brand?
I said, it's not for the faint of heart. So you guys have been startup guys. You know, it's like, I heard Gary Vee do a podcast the other day, and he said, entrepreneurship is like 1,000 losses with an occasional victory. And I think we all have to prepare yourself for that kind of adventure if you go down this road. But for us, it was always about, you know, starting with the product set first. And we have a very clear three-stage kind of proposal or business plan, if you will. And the first thing is, we have to put up a pioneering lighthouse brand for others to follow and define what we call regenerative fashion, which is, again, is a fashion brand that's made to ultimately from the elements to go back to the elements. And once we have that, we build a process to do that. So the raw materials that go into it, how you construct it with threads and closures and different materials like that, how you print, how you dye, how you do different how you actually prepare the product, how you then distribute the product, collect the product, turn the product back into nutrient-rich soil. And that is what we call regenerative creation model that we now have built as a process that feeds and kind of works our brand. And it seems kind of obvious, except when you look around that no one else is doing it. So we need to have a playbook on how to create a regenerative brand. So we've kind of built the brand, we built the playbook, and now we're starting to partner with others that are interested in this, because it's a hell of a story, to be quite honest. You talk about that singular story we did with Parley with the turtle trapped in a gill net. Now we talk about showing our product going in a way, going decomposing in a degenerative state where it's going back to be plant and worm food. And we do that now through partnerships. We've done one with Mammoetz. We've got a few more coming up this year. We're talking to some of the big incumbent brands because ultimately we want to scale this with the urgency the world needs and not just try to grow another 10 or 20 or $100 million brand. I want to systemically disrupt the $3 trillion fashion industry that stands today by showing everybody how to recreate this. And with my 30 years in the industry, I've got a chance to call on those and knock on those doors.
It's a fact that when you shift from a seat on a well-known brand where your calls are always returned, that you come to believe that it's you that people care to hear from. I had the experience of standing back from a position where I was the CEO of a large company I founded that did very well. And then I became not the CEO of that company. And my calls were not returned with quite the degree of enthusiasm and speed. I recall hiring someone to work for me years earlier, the late Tony Minert. He was the director of circulation of the Washington Post. I owned a wholesale distribution company at the time. And I hired him to be the president of our media division. And I remember him coming to my office some months later and he said, well, holy crap, I always thought people returned my calls because I was Tony Minert. Turned out it wasn't the Tony Minert part, it was the Washington Post part. What did you learn about humility from the experience of leaving Adidas and starting your own business?
You got to learn to be very humble and to be very tenacious and resilient. I think I do talk about this a bit, you know, from time to time. And I think you are judged. Your return call rate is a judgment of how you lived your executive life, like, you know, before. So for those people you would call that you knew when you were on that position, Tal, I think those are the ones they're going to show you whether you treated them respectfully or not when you were in a position of power. And, you know, talking about speaking truth to power, it's like that's when you find out what kind of executive you were. I am very humbled by the amount of people that still call me back, you know, whether they're in glorious positions or not. But I do know that now that I don't have Adidas attached to me, I am, you know, at an event, you know, standing behind a display of our products, you know, shucking shoes and shucking apparel, just like, you know, any kid just out of college or out of high school. And it's like, it's humbling, but it's also rewarding. But yeah, there's a fair amount of not callbacks, I would say. And at every level, at the investor level, at the retail level, at the, you know, just contacts, influencers, entertainers, you know, opportunities, other, you know, other brand level. I think that's something you just have to get used to. And when I speak to more and more people that have done this journey, this braving business journey, it's pretty much par for the course. I think everybody suffers from it. And that's kind of what makes it rewarding if you can build it and stack it up.
Yeah. No, that's very, very cool. You know, one of the things about your brand as you build, it's really about how you embody that, right? About how, like, being good, being kind, being generous to everyone is your brand, right? And that's for you, Eric. That's for Tal. That's for me. That's for pretty much anyone out there. That's how you gotta treat people, and that's how you survive. And being humble is definitely the right step in that. So it's so ambitious, right? You're leaving Adidas and you are, you know, you're
creating, Knob.
I know. Thank you. And you're creating something. I mean, like, you've met me, you're creating something new, right? That's out there. It's challenging. It challenges people. When you embark on something like that, like, sometimes the goal can be either so ostentatious, it's, you know, who knows if you're ever going to do it. It's almost evergreen, right? What is your evergreen goal? What's the evergreen goal of Unless Collective?
Well, listen, man, very clearly, we want to systemically change the fashion industry. That's kind of where we're going. And what I mean by that is moving it from a petroleum-based industry to a plant-based industry. And if you do if you dig down into that a little bit, you can see that plant-based polymers are following a similar trajectory to plant-based proteins. And we all know what's happened with plant-based proteins when you talk about Impossible Meat and Beyond Burger and Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger, I think it is. Anyway, you get the idea. you've seen these things happen. You've seen it happen in the dairy industry. I mean, oat-based milk, soy-based milk are really the growth engines of that industry now. So you can see it easily being applied to polymers. Now, having said that, you need to get everything in order from a unit economics, from a pricing parity to get to the same place within 3 to 5 years as where they are as they are today with oil as a feedstock. That's all in play. All that stuff, all my background from Adidas has taught me how to look for all those things and make sure those are all ready to go with the necessary volumes and not changing, you know, the infrastructure and not changing the heavy duty equipment that's used to make apparel and footwear in general. All these things can be plug and played into it just with a different polymer base. That's the evergreen goal. If you ask me, what does winning look like in my next 10 years? I think we need to give ourselves a goal of 10 to 15% of the industry being plant-based, polymer-based. And I don't think that's outrageous. And I think if you follow the electric vehicle conversion and the inflection points on that, then you can really start to see that can, you know, when you get to those numbers, that 5, 10, 15% inflection, then you really see the momentum swing in that direction in a major way. So it's about me really getting together with other visionary leaders of some of the big incumbent brands to model this out through collaborations and hopefully material supplier agreements.
Eric, one thing that entrepreneurs who are attempting to dramatically shift any industry would probably be looking for is some sort of a significant signal that they're registering, that something is shifting. What signal are you looking for? Do you know that? I mean, and if you do know it, how early on did you know this is the signal I'm looking for?
Well, the signal I got was the signal I got from the Parley for the Oceans, which is when we launched the first ever ocean plastic shoe in Manhattan, at the United Nations. That post went as far and as wide as anything we'd ever seen from Kanye or from Messi. And that was a signal I took back to the board at that point and saying, this is no longer philanthropy. This has crossed into good operational business, which is why the head of the brand's gonna charge this from the front. I've taken that and fast forward that, you know, almost 10 years now into this future and saying, now I think it's time to really do something beyond that, because ocean plastic in the meantime has become a floor item. Everyone can buy it. It's a supply chain. Everybody can talk about it. There's no uniqueness. What we offer is that unique story. That's the next step, which is plastic free. And I think with all the Gen Alpha coming up, where they're demanding that brands meet them where they are, and with policy coming down from New York Fashion Act or the EU's Fashion Acts, you're going to start to see the two combine. And this is going to be a mandatory solution that's going forward, because we can't deal with all the waste that we're producing right now in the world. The numbers are astounding. And today on Earth Day, you don't have to look very far to see those numbers on any website you want or any social media.
Yeah. Wow. First of all, very cool. Again, I use the word ostentatious, but that it is, it's ballsy, Eric. Way to go.
Why do anything that's not, you know, that's not trying to disrupt and change the world for better? I mean, I'm a firm believer, and we need to all look at ourselves in the mirror and are we really creating the change we want to see in our lives, personally, with our family, with our community, with our world? And if we're not, then why aren't we? I mean, existing is not very fun. Let's thrive.
Yeah, you know, I don't know exactly when this episode will run, but I just released a blog post on our website, bravingbusiness.com, about fear and how fear is a great opportunity to reflect on what is it really that you're trying to do and why are you trying to do it? It's going back to the proverbial why. You use Simon Sinek's why, and I think that's a wonderful baseline. But when you feel fear, and we had a recent guest, Frank McKinney, who was hugely successful. Wall Street Journal called him the real estate czar, and he said he feels fear every single day. Okay. And the reality is, if you use fear as a motivator, and I don't mean just to motivate you to just go forward no matter what, but to motivate you to reflect, to pause and reflect, am I living my values? Am I doing something I genuinely believe in? Am I really passionate about this? Do I really want to see this through? If the answer to those questions is yes, and they need to be a clear and resounding yes, then you soldier through the fear and you carry on because it's important. And like you said, someone's got to do it. And if you're in a position where you are willing to lead, lead. And it sounds like, Eric, you're doing exactly that. And I think that's hugely commendable. A lot of people would have coasted. A lot of people would have said, I'm being paid well. I'm doing the best I can. I'm going to try to influence from within. And I'm not saying that, even though it sounds like I'm saying that derisively, I'm not, because there's a case to be made for taking that approach. But if you are in your heart that passionate about something and you believe that strongly in it, and circumstances put you in a position where you can either afford to take the risk or you're willing to take the risk, take the risk. The world changes when people are bold. It does not change when we sit back, and it does not change by mistake. It changes where people choose to change it. And you're choosing to change it. I respect the hell out of that.
Very well said. I mean, I think we have to lean in. I mean, we have to create the change we want to see in the world. Whatever your vision for the world is, I mean, I'm getting active now in the Portland, political scene, only because, not because I'm going to run for office, but because why sit still? If you've got a homeless issue, let's address it. Let's figure out the operational excellence that we need to address these things instead of being, again, if you see something that bothers you, I don't understand how people cannot take action on
it. You know,
I don't.
Well, first of all, you're very inspiring. And I actually, I don't know. I don't think I've said that to a lot of people, but you are inspiring. We've had many very inspiring people on the show. Let me make sure I say that as well, that have been truly amazing. Right. But there is something very intriguing and something very, I don't know, like it's soul touching to know that even though, because I think like in capitalism in general, like a lot of people, you know, you get to the top and that's it. And for you to get to the top and then say, I got something bigger I want to tackle. And yeah, I can tackle it through my own environment now in my company, but I want to create something even larger. And I think that's just so amazing and so full of kudos for you. I don't know. It kind of makes me verklempt. Anyway, as we, you know, have listeners on this show who may very well be at the top of their prospective food chains, but they feel a calling to do something else, right? They're like, yeah, I'm kicking ass, but there's something else I can do. There's something else I can offer the world. But also that comes with a lot more risk to them. What questions do you think they should ask themselves before taking a leap like you did?
It's a great lead in. So I've got a personal philosophy right now that since I left Adi, it's called zero wasted hours. And it's had nothing to do with Adidas, but it's like when you're in the machine, you know it. And everyone in your audience knows this. You are in a meeting culture. You're in a culture of, you know, obligation a great deal. And so I'm like, hey, listen, if I'm not doing something for myself, for my family, for my friends, or for my world, I'm not doing it. I'm not taking that extra trip. I'm not sitting in that meeting because I've been invited to. I've sat in board meetings, day long board meetings, when I might have had 2 hours worth of you know content that I was really adding value to. But the next 8 hours, I was there learning and listening. This isn't criticism; it just was a culture of it. We have so many cultures of obligation. We need to get out. And if your listeners are feeling that, I would say you got to have a hard look in the mirror. And you know, I joke with Gabby Reese the other day. It's like the truth box is the sauna. Like you want to have a reflective time, get in a hot box and put yourself in a discomfort situation and you have to reflect inward. Or what do you think about when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning? I'll bet you it's not that board meeting. I'll bet you it's something else that's bothering you that might be more indicative of what you should be doing with your time and your resources. Because listen, everybody can make more money. But what's enough? And like, so what do we do now when we have enough of what we need to survive and thrive and have our families taken care of? What do we need to do to create a change in the world that we want to see that bugs us?
I will admit, Eric, that since I've turned 50, when I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's often because I have to pee. But your point's well taken.
Then can you get back to sleep?
Yeah. And what are you thinking about while you're peeing, Tal? We want to know. No, actually, we don't.
I will spare you. Our guest today, Eric Liedtke, truly a giant in the fashion industry. 26 years at Adidas. And now co-founder and CEO of the Unless Collective. Eric, if people are interested in finding more about the Unless Collective, or maybe their investors are looking to find out what you're doing and how they can take a part in it, or they're just consumers who want to support you, where would they go?
Okay, so they can buy our product, unlesscollective.com. They can hit me up at Eric Liedtke on LinkedIn. They can also find me on Instagram as well as Unless Collective. So it depends what your topic is. Feel free to direct message me, email me, just everything can go through LinkedIn or Instagram at this point. And then if we hit it off, we can take it to cell phones.
Sounds great. And we are going to have Eric's social media handles in the show notes. So if you're listening to this on any of the major podcast platforms, just open the show notes. And if you're watching this on YouTube, it will be there as well. Eric Liedtke, thank you so much for making time for us today. Continued success to you with Unless. You're doing something we all must pull for, because your success is good for the planet and good for our children, good for our grandchildren. And hopefully, you know what? Hopefully also good for your bottom line. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Take Eric. Care.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard and want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube, and please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.